in the hands of either soft Zionist organizations or hardcore Zionist organizations, and also remembering that, for example, Together for Palestine, the two founders of that organization, Anna Nolan and James Sadri, again, I repeat, are responsible for the narratives that finally brought down Syria, and are now responsible for the regime in Syria that is destroying the Palestinian movement within Syria itself. So they are not friends of Palestine. They are not friends of the region. They are not friends of the resistance against the Zionist bloc in the region. And therefore, if you want your funds to go where it should go, which is to Palestinian grassroots organizations, then you should be raising questions.
Well, that's all we've got time for today, but we'll be back next week. I'd like to thank our guest, Vanessa Bealey, and of course our resident expert, Professor David Miller. Until next time, when I hope you'll join us again on Palestine Declassified, this is Chris Williamson saying bye for now.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. السلام عليكم ورحمة الله.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints. The birthday of Muhammad, peace be upon him and his progeny, marks the greatest celebration in history. 2016, Imam Khamenei. After the passage of 3 years or more in the first phase of Bi'tha, the Holy Prophet ﷺ had managed to convert 30 or 40 people to Islam through his covert call to Islam. Then a divine order was issued, therefore declare openly that thou art commanded, and turn away from the polytheists. The Holy Quran, chapter 15, verse 94, requiring the Holy Prophet ﷺ to raise flag of Islam and to openly call people to Islam. The Holy Prophet ﷺ did so, being concerned about the safety of the Holy Prophet and his enemies' plots. Abi Talib went to him and told him the message of the chiefs of Mecca. Dear uncle, even if they place the sun in my right hand and the moon in my left hand to prevent me from achieving this goal, I swear by Allah that I will not do as they say. The Holy Prophet replied. Then the Prophet's eyes were filled with tears and he got up to leave. Having observed this faith and steadfastness, Abi Talib was impressed and said, "Dear nephew, go and say whatever you like." He told him to pursue his goal. "I swear by God that I will not give you away, no matter what I receive in return." This steadfastness bred more steadfastness. This steadfastness on the part of the Holy Prophet ﷺ strengthened the roots of steadfastness in the heart of Abi Talib. Pursuing the goals, not fearing the enemy, not being tempted by what the enemy has to offer, and not being dependent on the privileges that the enemy offers to prevent one from treading the path one believes in, give rise to resistance, peace, trust in the path, the goal, and God who this goal belongs to. There were not more than 30 or 40 of them. These 30 or 40 people tolerated all those hardships and increased in number on a daily basis. Each day, they were witness to what they did to Ammar and Bilal. They were witness to the torturing and martyrdom of Sumayyah and Yasir. They were witness to these things, but they still converted to Islam. That is the way righteousness is promoted. The mere rising of the flag in peace and security will not help promote righteousness. Righteousness will be promoted only when there is steadfastness and perseverance on the part of righteous people who believe in righteousness.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done.
Of beautiful Iran. IRIB Wannabe English Radio.
Welcome back, dear listeners. It's a pleasure to have you with us on Iran Radio here in the capital, Tehran. Here's what's just around the corner in the next hours. Our next segment offers a moment of reflection and wisdom. Join us for Hadith of the Day, hosted by Sheikh Muhammad Jafar Danish. This program presents a hadith from the Holy Prophet and members of his household, Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them all, every day along with a brief explanation and commentary on the hadith. In this program, hadiths relating to a particular lunar calendar date or solar calendar date are presented. Then it's time to explore how to achieve a fulfilling life with A to Z of life. Sister Zainab James will present an Islamic-Iranian lifestyle making use of the ayahs of the Holy Quran, hadith, as well as inspirational poetry, parables, and stories. Then it's time for the spotlight on the day's significant events. This daily program features a roundtable analysis and discussion of topical and controversial issues. Two expert guests provide insightful analysis. Don't miss it. Then it's time for Islamic Laws, hosted by Hujjatul Islam Sheikh Javed Akbari. This program focuses on Islamic jurisprudential rulings based on the fatwas of prominent scholars or maraji. Each episode addresses practical religious questions and explores common issues that arise in daily life. Next on deck, we have Hadith of the Day. Stay with us.
Oh Lord, here I am, pleading at your door. Send me your mercy, send me your peace, or I am lost for sure.
Hadith of the Day.
Here I am, yearning for your cure. This humble servant will be diverted from you no more, no more, no more.
You are listening to the program Hadith of the Day on Iran Radio with Sheikh Danish.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Dear brothers and sisters, salam and welcome to this episode of the Hadith of the Day. Imam Hassan Askari alayhi salam beautifully says, "Do not argue excessively, for it takes away your dignity. Do not argue excessively, for it takes away your dignity. And do not joke excessively, for it invites disrespect." Soft, thoughtful. Salam alaikum, dear brothers. Where we reflect on the timeless teachings of Ahlul Bayt alayhim salam, we can build our lives on a profound basis. Today we're diving into a wise and practical statement from Imam Hassan Askari alayhi salam. He says, "Do not argue, it takes away your dignity, and do not joke excessively, it invites people to disrespect you." So this short hadith addresses two very common behaviors: argumentation, or mira, which refers to constant debating, insisting on being right, and turning every conversation into a challenge to say, "I am right, what I'm saying is true," and so on. And excessive joking, or mizah, not humor in general, but overdoing it to the point that people no longer take you seriously. The Imam alayhi salam warns that both habits, while seemingly harmless, damage a person's dignity and social standing. Modern psychology supports this. People who argue often, especially in front of others, tend to lose respect. Why? Because arguing shifts the goal from truth to ego. And when ego takes over, listening stops. You won't listen to anyone any longer. Studies show that people who frequently engage in verbal conflict are more likely to suffer from social rejection and reputational damage, even if they win the debate. And it's been mentioned in many hadiths that even if you're right, do not argue excessively. Think of someone who always has to correct others or prove a point. At first, it might seem that like they're smart, they are so powerful, but soon others begin to avoid them. Now let's talk about joking. Humor is a gift. The Prophet ﷺ smiled often, and the Imams ﷺ enjoyed appropriate lightness. But the Imam ﷺ, Imam Hassan Askari, warns us, when you joke too much, people stop taking you seriously. It can erode boundaries, especially if jokes are at your own expense or disrespectful in tone. For example, a teacher or parent who constantly jokes might find that their children or students eventually ignore their authority, not out of malice, but because the line between respect and entertainment got blurred. So, inshallah, we take that into consideration. Do not argue excessively and do not joke excessively, inshallah. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
You just listened to the program Hadith of the Day on Iran Radio with Sheikh Danish.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad.
Tales full of sadness and woe, but I believe you smile again. You see, I know the pain you're feeling, 'cause I was there just like you. You'll be outcast. Sometimes it's better to be alone than to be with the bad crowd. Preserve your mind and feed it. Nourish what it is you have inside.
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, the worker. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to A to Z here on IRB English Radio with me, Sister Zainab. And so the title is The Worker, and by that I mean a person who has the sort of attitude or the demeanor of being very hardworking and really feeling so much in service, feeling so responsible, for example, towards the organization they're working for, especially if a person holds public office. Or then also, for example, if we're talking about a person who is on the battlefront and obviously is together with their fellow soldiers. So someone who then feels so responsible towards their fellow soldiers to sort of be there and also provide sort of encouragement and just keep the morale up by barely even taking time to recover from injury. So this is a sort of attitude that we see in all the martyrs of the Holy Defense. So they would typically, even though obviously they would have sort of leave from their active duties on the battlefront, very often we would see that they would actually cut their sort of break time short. For example, if they heard of, let's say, a new attack or a new operation, they would literally sort of maybe if they'd gone back to Tehran just over maybe even just a week or so with their family, they would often they would cut it short and just head straight back to sort of really just want to be there to help their obviously their fellow soldiers. And obviously this is something we also see in, for example, with the famous martyr of service, the former president of the Islamic Republic of Iran, Shahid Raisi, who it said of him that he didn't even take one day off holiday in the 3 years he was serving. So, you know, these are the sorts of, these are the sorts of attitudes that are quite amazing, really. Welcome back to A to Z here on IRB English Radio with me, Sister Zainab. And obviously I'm talking about this idea that we really want to serve. And obviously we see this service always as I've already mentioned, in all those who were in active duty, for example, during the Holy Defence, all the soldiers were on the battlefront. And for example, one of the famous martyrs, Dr. Mustafa Chamoran, one of the martyrs of the Holy Defence, even when he was injured, he would sometimes have cut short his recovery time and sort of insist on being back there amongst the soldiers. Or if he was, there's also a famous story where he was close to the front, I think. He was in the south west of Iran just trying to recover from an injury. And it's really hot, and the air conditioning didn't work, and people were going to sort out for him. He said no, he didn't want to have any more privileges or benefits compared to his fellow soldiers on the front. So it's this sort of idea. And then obviously we think back to ourselves, okay, so what do we do with this? And obviously there are two different viewpoints here. Obviously, the one is these are people who are in active duty, in service. So, for example, I mentioned Shahid Reisi, the martyr of national service, who took not even one day's leave in his 3 years of service. And then obviously I've mentioned the martyrs of the Holy Defence, who would take very little time up for themselves or their families. And then against that, we also have the concept of, in Islam, that we're supposed to also balance our day. So no, we're not, for us, like normal people, we're not in this sort of active duty, who are going have our normal lives just... So maybe not in a sort of top official position. We should have time for recreation. We should have time for family, time for worship. We should work. So this is also important. So we need to balance that. So unless we really are serving in a very important position, serving the country, serving, for example, the Islamic government, then obviously we should also respect the fact that we have to also balance our day. So there's two different positions in there. So maybe sort of think about that and see which one is going to sort of be more applicable in your lives. Because obviously we need to also sort of sustain ourselves and recover from our daily work to some extent. So inshallah, that's just a reminder for all of us, and look forward to welcoming you to another episode of HZ here on Iron Bingish Radio, and farewell for now. Thank you very much for listening to this episode of A to Z. And for more information, please also visit our website at www.iranradio.ir.
We are with you. What about you? Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
Now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
The New York Declaration, hailed by its architect as a roadmap to peace, has ignited fierce controversy over its treatment of Palestinian rights. While 142 nations endorsed the resolution at the UN General Assembly, critics argue that its emphasis on disarming Hamas and excluding it from governance, coupled with vague commitments to Palestinian sovereignty, masks a deeper failure to confront the realities of occupation, displacement, and systemic inequality. By prioritizing geopolitical optics and appeasing Western narratives, the declaration risks entrenching the very injustices it claims to resolve. I am Bahman Urayen. In tonight's Spotlight, We ask that this document represent a genuine step towards justice or a diplomatic sleight of hands that sidelines the Palestinian struggle. Let us begin with a short report.
Amid rising tensions across West Asia and the genocide in Gaza, the UN General Assembly has adopted a text endorsing a landmark declaration concerning the realization of an independent state of Palestine. The measure is known as the New York Declaration. 142 members voted in favor of it, 10 against, and 12 countries abstained from the vote, including Iran, Iraq, and Tunisia. The declaration, which was already endorsed by the Arab League, seeks to fully exclude Hamas from leadership in Gaza. Iran's UN mission has listed the reasons why it did not vote in favor of the resolution.
The statement fails to adequately address the root causes of the crisis in the West Asia region and does not provide a realistic solution to end the prolonged conflict. The statement ignores the reality of the Zionists' presence in Palestinian territories and their ongoing occupation. The statement irresponsibly shares the responsibility for continuing this long tragedy, equally between the apartheid occupying regime and the people under occupation. The statement's attempt to condemn the Palestinian right to legitimate defense on October 7, 2023, and justify the disproportionate and horrific crimes of the Israeli regime against Palestinians in response to this right is utterly unacceptable and strongly rejected.
Iran's UN mission stressed that lasting peace in the region can only be achieved through the establishment of an independent, sovereign Palestinian state. The UNGA resolution also called for the disarmament of Palestinian resistance groups. Hamas and other groups say this contradicts international law, which recognizes the rights of the people under occupation. The UN General Assembly's vote came less than 24 hours after Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said there would never be a Palestinian state. The New York Declaration vote precedes the upcoming UN summit co-chaired by Riyadh and Paris on September 22 in New York. French President Emmanuel Macron and several other leaders have promised to formally recognize the Palestinian state during the summit. Around three-quarters of the 193 UN member states recognize the Palestinian state proclaimed in 1988 by the exiled Palestinian leadership.
Welcome back. Allow me to get into the conversation with Saeb Shahz, author and West Asia expert, who is with me right now from Belfast. Very good to have you, Mr. Shahz. It's a pleasure to have you on the program. I want to talk to you about, let's go to the heart of the matter. Do you think this declaration's failure to explicitly condemn Israeli occupation and blockade, do you think this kind of violates international legal norms under the Fourth Geneva Convention?
It does, since the responsibility of an occupying power, again, according to the Geneva Convention and its annexes, is to protect the occupied land and not to change any of its landmarks, not to change its demography, not to mistreat the civilians. And then we have the international Court of Justice in The Hague had an opinion which is came out last year calling the Zionist entities' presence in the occupied West Bank or Gaza Strip or Jerusalem, East Jerusalem, is illegal, and listed all the illegalities and asked the Zionist entity and the international community and the state actors and non-state actors to help in dismantling the occupation in the West Bank. So once we talk about the West Bank and the Gaza Strip and East Jerusalem, every aspect of that is illegal under international law. And there is in here contradiction with what the United Nations vote for and General Assembly or demanding the Palestinian people to do. We must pay attention to the declaration when it orders the Palestinians, and especially Hamas, who is an elected government by the Palestinian people, and that's the one who overseen these elections was the former President Jimmy Carter of the United States of America. So when they asked them, Hamas must end its role in Gaza, and have and hand over its weapons to the Palestinian Authority. And they say this is in line with the objective of the sovereign and independent Palestinian state. And let me just dismantle that little bit here for you. We have, as Palestinian people, experience with something which they are building on it in here. They called at the time, they call it the Fahd Peace Plan, which is known after that, the Fahd Peace Initiative. And that, and nice. Then they called it the Fez Initiative, since it was a proposal went for the Arab League Summit in 1982 in Morocco, in the city of Fez. And the Saudi crown prince then, Fahd, he is presented that, and they this in that 1981 they disagreed upon there, because they exclude the Palestinian PLO as a representative from the whole thing, and then they call for the solution to have Palestinian independent state in the West Bank and Gaza Strip and Jerusalem as a capital, while they're recognizing for a free the Zionist entity is swallowing the risk of historical Palestine. After that, what happened? The Zionist entity went and occupied Lebanon in 1982, and they declared after that they control most of Lebanon. The international community, led at the time by the American President Reagan, sent their own diplomats to broker kind of agreement, the PLO, to leave Lebanon in 1982. And the PLO agreed that, since it is not Palestinian territory, but with a kind of agreement with the Americans to protect the Palestinian refugee camps, Sabra and Shatila, for example, in here. They agreed with the Americans and the French, and the American and the French deployed 2,000 soldiers to protect the Palestinian refugee camps in Sabra and Shatila. And once the PLO, the Palestinian, left Lebanon in there, what happens? 4 days later, these forces left, withdrawn from the refugee camps. Suddenly, Sharon, the defense minister of the Zionist entity, sent in the Lebanese forces and the Lebanese phalange under the supervision of the supposed to be Zionists and the peacekeepers, American and French, slaughtered all the Palestinians in there. And that was the agreement, the signature of the president of the United States of America, Jimmy Carter, and the French president at the time as well. So how the Palestinian will accept and will believe the international community when they ask them to hand over their weapons, while the top leadership of the West...
We are going to, of course, cover those because we have a lot of questions. I would really appreciate it if you kept the answers more briefly. I wanted to talk exactly, we're going to talk about the disarmament as well. Well, you know that several Arab countries and also Iran abstained from the vote. And the reasons, some of them, especially the Iranian envoy, vocally criticized this declaration for failing to address the root causes of the West Asia crisis. Does its focus on short-term stabilization and disarmament offer a realistic path to peace? Or do you think it merely treats the symptoms while ignoring the structural injustices that perpetuate the conflict?
It's a plan to disarming the Palestinian people. And as I said, what I was speaking about in 1982 and the phase thing, it developed to what they call it the Arab Initiative of 2002, which is as well by an Arab summit. And none of these leaders at the time consider even to postpone this conference with the Arab summit to allow Arafat, who was besieged at the time in Ramallah, to attend that conference. And it went on the back of that thing, which is to create a kind of entity, a weak entity in the Palestinian occupied West Bank and Gaza Strip, and didn't emphasize in the right of return for the Palestinians. Let's go with what the French are thinking, even if we listen to what the French Foreign Minister Jean Noel Parrot called as fundamental step to isolating Hamas internationally and regionally. He called that the declaration of New York at the time when the Arabic 17 countries signed it and some of the Arab. He said to the France Inter Radio on Friday, September 12th will be remembered as the day Hamas's final international isolation. So we can understand what that means. Hamas to them, they mean the Palestinian resistance, the Palestinian right for self-determination and to have their own territory and their own state free from Zionist kind of hegemony and security control and occupation. In that kind of possible ceasefire, they talking about deploying what? A temporary international stabilization mission into Gaza. It means as well, plus the Zionist entity occupation, we're going to have international kind of forces in there, which is undercover. They're going to protect the Palestinian people and to provide the civilian population with support and security. We'll find ourselves under more Western occupation since the Zionist entity wasn't able to defeat the Palestinian resistance. They want to cheat it diplomatically in such a kind of hollow resolutions.
Right, Mr. Sarchas. Well, gladly now we have Said Mohsen Abbas, political analyst and activist, also joining us from London. Said Mohsen Abbas, of course, you know what we are talking about, the New York Declaration. Another, something very weird is about this declaration is that it calls for a two-state solution and urges Israel to halt settlement activity, and yet it fails to explicitly name or confront the ongoing occupation. What does that say about the credibility of such a declaration?
Well, it has no credibility, as with anything that comes from the Zionist Western fraternity. You have to take it with a pinch of salt. The reality is that we know that this drumbeat about two-state solution has been building up. And of course, a lot of the so-called pressure that has been building up on Israel from Western governments, you know, the token efforts that have been made, the threat to accept a Palestinian state, for instance, all these things are being touted around, but you have to think about who's doing this. There is a neoliberal Zionist soft power movement, which is hand in glove, I think, with the hard power Netanyahu sort of murderous genocidal fraternity, but is deliberately kettling people into saying, well, you know, now that you've seen what Netanyahu can do and what the hardline Zionists can do, actually come over and we'll give you the liberal Zionist solution. And the liberal Zionist solution has no intention of dismantling Israel. It has no intention of giving Palestinians the real rights that they deserve, the justice that is actual justice. They have no intention of ever allowing an armed resistance to take shape. They oppose the axis of resistance, which actually has sacrificed people on the ground. So you can see that this is just another kind of, it's a kind of another psyop, another psychological operation to try and herd the Palestinians into whatever they want. Now, if, for instance, the Palestinian resistance was disarmed, we have track records of what the Israelis do when they have a disarmed Palestinian movement. Just remember Sabra and Shatila and what they did in the camps in Sabra and Shatila to the Palestinians and murdering the women, children. So they kill them, whether there's an armed resistance or not. It's just that if there's no armed resistance, of course, the Israelis can do it much more easily and they can control the Palestinians more easily. And that's what I think that they're aiming for. That's what all this noise is about. So this bogus NY declaration, so-called, is just another part of that.
Right, Said Mohsen, thank you so much for that answer. Well, Mr. Shah, also wanted to talk to you about another aspect of this declaration, which kind of assigns equal responsibility between for the ongoing conflict to both the occupier and the occupied. How do you think a framework with the power that doesn't consider the power imbalance between the occupier and the occupied be considered credible?
This is in itself flies on the face of international law, that kind of equation. Since by international law, the Palestinian people are entitled for self-determination. And this is, was as well said in the, with the Hague, Court of the Hague, to enable the Palestinian people to be able to for the right to practice their right of self-determination. That means how you'll be able to fulfill that. You are legally entitled to use all means to resist occupation. And we understand the international law with dealing with the occupiers. You cannot say the occupiers have the right to self-determination while they are occupying my country. And I am, as a liberation front, trying to liberate my country from occupation. They cannot deal with that. And I'll give you an example, which is applicable to Palestine right now. The Nazi occupation of France, when the Charles de Gaulle was leading the French resistance from the communists to the socialists, to the right, to the left, against the Nazi. And the Nazi there, to make their occupation of France cheaper, they formed what they call it the Vichy regime in there. And the people now, are they expecting the international community to support what's equal to the Vichy regime and hand it over or the territories? That's what I mean. The Palestinian Authority in Ramallah today is equal to the Vichy regime in France at the time. People supported the resistance. People supported Charles de Gaulle and the independence, really true independence of France. Why, when it's come to Palestine, different double standards have to be used? We have to support, and the international community going to support PA, which it didn't send one policeman to protect one farmer from the Palestinian farmers in the West Bank who's been attacked or killed, or and their land being destroyed and their cattle being poisoned or stolen by the Zionist settlers. Only it looks after the interests of the Zionists, keep security for the interests of the Zionist entity. So this is the double standards in here. And telling the people, the PA representing the Palestinian people, I say very clearly, with the PA, with that stand and that position and that track record in the West Bank, which is the settlers from nearly 60,000 in 1993 were in the West Bank, till today nearly a million under their watchful eyes of the Palestinian authority. They don't represent the Palestinian people. And to hand the control and of the West Bank and Gaza to them and to destroy the Palestinian resistance, it flies against justice, and it flies in the face of the Palestinian people's right to self-determination.
Right. You rightfully pointed to the Palestinians' right to self-determination. Said Mohsen, I wanted to talk about this proposed transfer of authority to the Palestinian Authority without elections. Don't you think this kind of violates Palestinians' rights to self-determination?
Absolutely. I mean, they've been violating Palestinian rights from day dot. They continue to impose the apartheid state. There's no talk about neutering Israel in any way, shape or form. There's no talk about de-Zionizing the Middle East or West Asia, whatever you want to call it. There's no talk of really giving Palestinians equal rights. It's all to do with just a backdoor Abraham Accords, isn't it, really? I mean, Abraham Accords is all about surrender. It's about capitulation. I think one of the greatest PFLP leaders, who was assassinated many, many years ago, said negotiations and these kinds of declarations, you know, you're giving us the choice of what? The sword and the neck. Basically, that's what they want. They want the Palestinian neck to be placed on a wooden stump so that the Israeli sword can fall on it as and wish, how they wish. And of course, you've got the people like Abbas, basically traitors, sellouts, puppets. There are many of these kinds of puppets around the Arab world. If they didn't exist, the reality is Israel wouldn't exist for one day. You have these kinds of puppets in Saudi Arabia, you have them in Qatar, you have them in Kuwait, you have them across all of the Gulf, and that is the reason that the people are powerless, because these agencies take money from the Anglo-Zionist Empire, and then they impose torture, subjugation, surveillance, and control on their people. And they therefore shut up the Arabs from being able to say and do what they really want. And that's exactly what's happening with the PA in that region. And that's what they want to see. By pushing these agendas of the PA taking full charge, what they want is a capitulation, a surrender, an absolute subjugation. And they won't stop there. Once they have the likes of the PA, what you can guarantee is that the push for for their new acquisition in the West Bank, I've forgotten what they call it, Samarra, and I think something else, Judea, I think they call it. That's already on the books of people like Smotrich, Netanyahu, and the like. They are basically already wanting to annex that territory. They want Jordan, for goodness sake. They want the west of Jordan as well. They're already pushing beyond into Syria. They want to go to the Euphrates. People need to smell the coffee. Doesn't matter what other things you say or do, Greater Israel is on the agenda, and Netanyahu is after that, and the Americans will support him in whatever shape or form they want. So you have to stop them at the root, and the root is to stop them annexing Palestine and basically marginalizing it through their puppets.
Right, and one final question, Mr. Shav, please answer in like 30 seconds, because we do not have more time. Could the disarmament clause be interpreted as criminalizing Palestinian resistance under occupation, contrary to UN-recognized rights of oppressed people?
That's when the French foreign minister, Perot, told the French media, the 12th of September will be remembered as the day of Hamas' final international isolation. This is what they want. And as I said, what Hamas, when they say Hamas, they don't mean Hamas as a group. They mean Hamas as the Palestinian resistance as a whole. Anybody who holds the gun to face occupation to them is Hamas. Or the French want to make it sounds like they are the final international isolation for them, which is they are terrorists. They want to label the Palestinian resistance as a terrorist. The Palestinian resistance are freedom fighters who are trying to liberate and will liberate their country from this satanic occupation, which is supported by all Western countries. France was one of the first countries to arm the Zionist entity with a nuclear reactor technology. They're the one who armed the Zionist entity before the Americans with up the state-of-the-art technology from the Mirage fighters up to the cannons, to the guns, to the nuclear reactors.
Right, thank you so much, gentlemen. I wanted this conversation to go on for hours, but unfortunately, for the sake of time, we have to call it a night. It was a pleasure to have you both on this program, Mr. Saeb Shaath, author and West Asia expert, joining us from Belfast, and also Said Mohsen Abbas, joining us on the 11th hour. Thank you so much for being here, political activist and political analyst, joining us from London. And thank you so much for being with us on another Spotlight.
Cause you mean everything, hear you talking when you're sleeping. Reality, know you're going through hardship, and I know that you're scared, but you don't need to worry, cause Allah is there. Ooh, oh, I will never let you go. You're my heart, my love, my soul, and the choices that we make, we gotta make our own. Gonna stand on our feet. Take this direction. When we take on the world, all the diamonds and pearls, couldn't take me away from your smile.
hardship comes ease. If you ask me, why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me, proudly I would say, I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way, all covered up in a world that gives it all away, proudly she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed, smiling he would say,
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God, welcome to another edition of the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Saweed, our guest speaker. Assalamu alaikum, Sheikh, and welcome to the program.
Alaykum as-salam wa rahmatullah. It's a pleasure to be with you.
The pleasure is all mine. Well, we have started discussing some of the jurisprudential laws related to medical issues, based on the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei from a couple of episodes ago onwards. And we'd like to continue along the same line. And I'd like to ask you this question first at the beginning of this episode, Sheikh Javid. What's the general law, jurisprudential law, in the matter of abortion itself? Is this ruling or the ruling different if keeping the baby poses a danger to the mother's life? Which one's life is more important, the mother's or the baby? Because there might be a danger actually posed to the baby's life, and also we have another situation where the mother is endangered.
Of course, it's always the life of the mother that is more important in such cases. And of course, the fetus, which has not yet become alive and soul has not been infused to the fetus, is not important compared to the mother's life, mm-hmm. of course.
Mm-hmm.
So coming to your question, aborting the fetus, as we said, is forbidden according to Islamic Sharia.
Mm-hmm.
The Islamic Sharia does not allow abortion under any circumstances, except for a few exceptions, which I will mention. It is not permissible under any circumstances to have an abortion, except I'm giving the exceptions, mentioning the exceptions, except when pregnancy poses danger to the mother's life. And in this case, of course, there's no objection to terminating the pregnancy before the soul has entered the fetus.
Mm-hmm.
And if this spirit or the soul enter the fetus, it is not permissible to abort it, even if the pregnancy spells